Welcome to the Deep Dive, your shortcut to making sense of the world's most crucial information. I'm Jamie Murdoch.
And I'm Taylor Newhouse. It's a real pleasure to be exploring this material with you today.
We're here to strip away the information overload, revealing the surprising facts and crucial connections you need to feel truly well-informed.
Exactly.
Today, we're embarking on a comprehensive exploration of a particularly significant publication, The Economist, for the week of August 9th to August 16th, 2025.
And this issue is absolutely packed. We're talking critical global events, economic shifts that are, you know, reshaping markets, and societal trends that really demand our collective attention.
It sounds like a lot to cover.
It is, from the ongoing complexities in the Middle East and the profound humanitarian challenges there to, well, tectonic plates shifting in global trade and even the very fabric of scientific integrity itself. Yeah, we've got a tremendous amount to explore.
Okay. So if you're ready to move beyond just the headlines and truly understand the why and how behind these major stories.
And maybe get a few of those aha moments.
Hopefully. Those moments that make dense topics genuinely fascinating. Then let's begin our deep dive into this week's Economist. All right, our first deep dive takes us right into the heart of global conflicts. Specifically, the dire situation in Gaza that The Economist details this week, it paints a truly stark picture of devastation.
Yeah, and the numbers painting that picture are, well, they're incredibly stark. The article highlights the immense scale of destruction since the October 7th, 2023 attack.
Right.
By July 29th, the Hamas-run health ministry reported at least 60,000 Palestinians killed, with thousands more still believed to be buried under rubble. Uncounted.
Just staggering numbers. And beyond those tragic direct numbers, the article then shifts to illustrate the really profound secondary humanitarian costs.
Exactly, like that study from Royal Holloway, University of London.
Yeah, that one estimated an additional 4,500 to 12,500 indirect deaths by January 2025, just from a lack of medical care.
Right. And then there's the physical destruction. Satellite data indicates that roughly 60% of Gaza's buildings have been damaged or completely destroyed.
60%. The article vividly describes this as a biblical scale of death and destruction. The sheer scope is, well, it's frankly almost impossible to fully comprehend.
And against this backdrop of immense destruction and loss of life, one of the central discussions in the article revolves around the accusations of war crimes leveled against Israel.
Okay.
It categorizes these accusations into three main areas. First, you have actions by individual soldiers, things like alleged shootings of civilians or mistreatment of prisoners.
Right.
Second, operational decisions. Think airstrikes that disproportionately harm civilians, even if the intended target was military.
Uh-huh.
And finally, cabinet-level policies, which have had a, you know, a direct and significant impact on the humanitarian situation on the ground.
And this brings up a really critical point about the role of international law, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
The International Criminal Court, the ICC, has actually issued arrest warrants for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former defense minister, Yoav Gallant,
citing the war crime of starvation as a method of warfare, among other alleged crimes against humanity.
Yeah. And adding to that international pressure, South Africa accused Israel of genocide at the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, just 12 weeks after October 7th.
Wow. Hmm.
It really highlights a deeply troubled landscape from a legal standpoint, and a significant amount of what's often called lawfare being waged on the international stage.
Right, using legal proceedings for political or military aims.
Exactly.
And the article then critically examines Israel's own internal system for policing war crimes. This includes the Fact-Finding and Assessment Mechanism, or FFM, and the Military Advocate General, the MAC.
Okay, so how are they functioning?
Well, these systems exist, and they have apparently been beefed up with dozens of investigators, but they're described as slow, often focusing investigations and indictments on lower-ranking soldiers.
Right, not the higher-ups making policy.
Exactly. And they're seen by critics as susceptible to whitewashing. For instance, in the first year of the war, only about 15 soldiers were indicted for battlefield conduct.
15 out of?
Out of hundreds of allegations. And most of those were for things like looting and theft, with only a few cases related to brutal treatment of inmates.
It's quite telling that an IDF officer admitted that many cases don't even get investigated because, well, there are no official complaints filed.
Yeah, and a senior military judge noted that hundreds of allegations simply overwhelm the existing system, makes it incredibly difficult to establish clear norms through indictments.
So a lot might just fall through the cracks.
It seems likely. And stepping back to the broader context, the silence of Attorney General Gali Baharov Miara is noted as particularly striking.
She's the one who challenged Netanyahu on judicial overhaul, right?
That's her. Known for publicly challenging him on that. Yet she hasn't publicly challenged the government's war policies, including plans to force 2 million Gazans into a so-called humanitarian city.
Which some Israeli experts themselves view as potentially war crimes or ethnic cleansing.
Correct. Even the Supreme Court, despite its previous clashes with Netanyahu, backed the government's aid blockade policy. They stated Israel wasn't using starvation as a weapon and put the blame on Hamas.
It raises serious questions about the independence of these institutions during wartime, doesn't it?
It really does. The challenge of holding power to account in the midst of conflict.
And meanwhile, the humanitarian crisis on the ground, tragically, just continues to deepen. It's heartbreaking to read about the deliberate obstruction of aid.
Yeah, Israel stated its goal was preventing Hamas from pilfering supplies. But the consequences for the civilian population are, well, undeniably devastating.
The article highlights the profound health impact. 1 in 3 pregnancies are now high risk.
And a tenfold increase in stillbirths between January and June. Tenfold.
Unbelievable. And between April and mid-July, 20,000 children were hospitalized for acute malnutrition.
20,000. And this severe lack of food and essential nutrients. It isn't just about immediate hunger. It has a profound, potentially irreversible impact on brain development.
Creating a long-term crisis for an entire generation.
Exactly.
And here's a detail that really brings home the stark reality for you. It's deeply disturbing. Hamas itself released a propaganda video.
Right, of the Israeli hostage, Aviatar David.
Yes, showing him emaciated, recounting his starvation. But then his captor's hand is visible in the frame, and it appeared chubby.
That visual contrast, it just underscores the immense suffering and the shocking disparity in conditions. It's quite chilling.
A core revelation in the article, though, is the shifting opinions, both within Israel and internationally.
Yes, it details a growing internal dissent within Israel. Mainstream news outlets, which had previously largely avoided showing suffering in Gaza, are now beginning to show footage of the emaciated.
That's a significant shift.
It is. And former generals, left-wing politicians, academics, they're increasingly questioning the war's rationale. Accusations of genocide are described as no longer taboo, even among prominent Israeli human rights organizations.
Wow. So a real change in the public discourse there.
It suggests so. Meanwhile, in the U.S., the political landscape is also seeing some notable shifts.
How so?
Well, while Speaker Mike Johnson and the Republican establishment continue their, you know, pretty uncritical support for Israel.
Johnson even visited West Bank settlements, didn't he? Calling them rightful property?
He did. But a disenchantment is apparently growing within parts of the Majage movement. Marjorie Taylor Greene, for example, used the word genocide on X, the platform formerly known as Twitter. And Steve Bannon noted declining support among the under 30 Majage base, who are influenced by these graphic social media images of suffering coming out of Gaza.
So a potential fracturing of that traditionally strong Republican pro-Israel stance, particularly among younger people.
Potentially, yes. Donald Trump, however, remains firmly on Israel's side. He even intervened to support Netanyahu against corruption charges, having his ambassador attend the trial.
Right. And he floated that idea of turning Gaza into a Riviera.
Yes, a very provocative idea that apparently fanned hopes on Israel's hard right about, well, potentially moving Palestinians out of the territory altogether.
It shows a continuation of his, let's say, pragmatic, sometimes unsettling approach to foreign policy. Different calculations.
Definitely different calculations. Now, beyond Gaza, the war in Sudan continues relentlessly, often overshadowed by other global headlines.
Right. El Fasher, the capital of North Darfur.
Under siege by the Rapid Support Forces, the RSF. It's leading to imminent starvation for its 300,000 residents. Food prices there are 5 times higher than elsewhere.
And aid can't get in.
The UN World Food Program has trucks ready, but access is blocked. It's tragically the world's worst humanitarian crisis by displacement. Nearly 13 million people affected.
13 million, yet it gets so little attention.
A fraction of the attention. The article underscores this immense tragedy unfolding largely out of the international spotlight. And it highlights the growing potential for a permanently fractured state there.
A profoundly unstable future for the country and the region.
Indeed.
Okay, next, let's turn our attention to the authoritarian front. The Economist highlights the concerning situation with Nayib Bukele in El Salvador.
Yes, his Legislative Assembly, which is completely dominated by his New Ideas Party, they voted to remove presidential term limits.
Allowing him to rule for life, essentially. He's only 44.
Exactly. It's a truly alarming development for democracy in the region, and it prompts us to ask, what does this mean for the state of democracy across Latin America?
His tough tactics are pretty well known.
Oh, yes, a rolling state of emergency for over 3 years now. 85,000 people jailed without trial. Documented instances of torture in prisons by authorities.
And the crackdown is expanding beyond just criminals.
It seems so. Human rights defenders, journalists, lawyers, some, like those from the investigative outlet El Faro, have had to flee the country.
And it's notable that Donald Trump has praised him, right? Called him a great friend.
Yes, praised his jailing of deported migrants. It really showcases a clear alignment of these sort of populist strongman leadership styles.
Shifting gears slightly to trade and strategic assets, Panama is now caught in a lawfare battle over the Panama Canal ports.
Right. This is a fascinating intersection of legal maneuvering and geopolitical power plays over really crucial global infrastructure.
What's happening exactly?
Well, Panama's Comptroller General is trying to revoke the contract of CK Hutchison. That's a Hong Kong-based conglomerate that operates two key ports, one at each end of the canal.
And this comes after Trump vowed to take back the canal?
It does. And it also follows a stalled $23 billion deal by BlackRock and MSC to acquire those ports. That deal apparently stalled because China demanded its state-owned shipping firm, COSCO, be a veto-holding member of the consortium.
So China wanted control.
Effectively, yes. And Panama's decision to try and revoke Hutchison's contract came just 3 days after that deal was supposed to close. The timing is suggestive.
Panama's move certainly seems to align with U.S. interests, then.
It does seem that way. But the article warns that while there's maybe no immediate risk for the U.S. in this, Panama itself will suffer.
How so? Backlash from China.
Potential backlash, yes. Diplomatic actions, litigation based on illegal expropriation. It really highlights the difficult position smaller nations are in when caught between global superpowers vying for strategic control.
A tough spot to be in.
Definitely. Now, connecting this to the bigger picture of global power plays, Pakistan's Army Chief, Field Marshal Asim Munir, has been cozying up to Donald Trump.
Even had a private lunch at the White House.
Apparently so. This follows that brief conflict with India, where Munir showed a greater appetite for risk than his predecessor, resisting pressure not to respond to India's initial strikes. It suggests a more assertive posture from Pakistan.
And Trump, for his part, has dramatically escalated trade tensions with India, called it a dead economy.
He did, and imposed tariffs of 25%, then quickly raised them to 50% on Indian imports, all while hailing a new trade deal with Pakistan.
That's a huge shift from his previous bromance with India's Prime Minister Modi.
A very dramatic shift. And India's significant reliance on Russian oil, which has surged to 35-40% of its imports since the Ukraine war, is a key point of contention for Trump.
The U.S. wants India to cut that off completely.
The article says the U.S. is serious about pressuring India to go to zero, which could involve financial sanctions on any bank, port, or firm facilitating those Russian sales.
That could really shake up markets, given India's size and energy needs.
It poses a potential storm for otherwise calm markets, absolutely, especially given India's historical non-alignment.
And domestically in Pakistan, Field Marshal Munir is consolidating power.
Yes, leading to rumors he might become president, though a spokesman denies it. His popularity surged after the skirmish with India. He's seen as pious but pragmatic, though also with a vindictive streak towards rivals.
So this consolidation of power, plus the tensions with India, it raises the risk of a bigger clash.
The article suggests it truly raises the risk of a bigger clash between these nuclear strongmen in South Asia. It's a worrying dynamic.
Okay, shifting tone slightly, let's look at some global cultural shifts mentioned.
Right. We see Islamist parties gaining ground in Malaysia, particularly among the young.
Why is that happening?
It's attributed partly to a decades-long Islamization drive in government and society, but also, importantly, the powerful influence of social media. Savvy imams and political parties are racking up millions of views online.
Creating echo chambers.
The concern is exactly that deepening the country's religious cleavages, potentially impacting its multicultural fabric.
And on the nuclear front, the 80th anniversary is of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yeah, they highlight a really worrying trend. The world entering a third nuclear age, described as messier and more combustible than ever before.
Even Japan's prime minister, while speaking of a nuclear-free world, relies on nuclear deterrence.
Right, Japan refuses to sign the new UN treaty banning nuclear weapons. And the really poignant part is the fading voices of the Hibakusha, the atomic bomb survivors. Their average age is now 86.
So their firsthand accounts are disappearing.
Exactly. And the article raises a critical question about memory and the future, suggesting a potential link between their diminishing presence and the rise of this new, perhaps more perilous, nuclear era.
A chilling thought. Okay, let's bring it home now and dive into U.S. domestic politics. It seems total war is underway over electoral redistricting.
Yeah, and what stands out here is just the sheer partisanship of it all. It's turned what should be, you know, a somewhat technical process into this hyper-polarized pastime.
Like the Texas example, Republicans proposing mid-cycle redistricting.
Exactly. The goal was to gain 5 House seats, aiming for 30 out of 38 total, even if they only won the statewide popular vote by a small margin. Democratic lawmakers literally left the state to deny quorum.
A dramatic move, though likely to fail, right?
Expected to fail, and the plan faces legal challenges. But it shows the lengths parties will go to.
But the real depth of the analysis comes when California's Governor Gavin Newsom countered with his own promulgation on social media.
Right. He reposted this particularly egregious pro-democratic gerrymander designed by an anonymous user. It would supposedly eliminate all 9 Republican-held congressional districts in California.
All 9? Wow. And Arnold Schwarzenegger is getting involved.
Reportedly ready to return to politics to campaign actively against it. It just highlights the incredibly high stakes and even the celebrity involvement in these battles.
So the article points out that Democrats face some inherent obstacles in this redistricting war.
Yes. A key reason is voter geography. Democratic voters tend to be more concentrated in urban areas,
making it easier for Republicans to pack them into fewer districts.
Exactly, packing them in, which dilutes their overall electoral impact. Plus, in many large Democratic states like California and New York, they've already handed redistricting power over to independent commissions.
Like in New York, where the court struck down partisan maps.
Precisely. New York's Court of Appeals struck down proposed districts due to a state ban on partisan gerrymandering. That effectively removed a significant opportunity for Democrats to gain an edge there.
So what does this all mean for the balance of power in the House?
Well, the theoretical numbers, if you just look at potential maps, suggest maybe a draw. Democrats could redraw maybe 35 Trump 1 districts, Republicans 34 Harris 1 districts.
But the practical constraints.
Right. Voter geography, independent commissions, they likely hobble Democrats disproportionately. So in a close national election, something like that specific Texas gerrymander designed to grab 5 extra seats.
That could actually decide control of the House.
It potentially could. It makes these seemingly technical battles incredibly impactful for the entire country.
Okay, this next topic feels deeply connected to that political landscape and maybe the health of democratic institutions. Donald Trump's war on numbers.
Yeah, a core revelation here is the direct assault on the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the BLS, a nonpartisan institution long respected for its independence.
Trump fired the commissioner, Erica McIntyre.
He did, alleging, without providing any evidence, that her department was manipulating employment figures to make his administration look bad.
That's a pretty significant breach of norms, isn't it?
A huge breach of established norms for how a president interacts with federal statistical agencies.
And this came after the BLS reported, 73,000 new jobs in July, but then revised down May and June's numbers.
Revised them down by a whopping 258,000 jobs combined, making them the lowest for job creation since early 2020, right at the start of the pandemic.
Why was the revision so large?
Economists are struggling to understand fully. They cite technical reasons. Maybe the economy is at a turning point. Maybe declining survey response rates are a factor. But the deeper concern is how this impacts a long-term credibility of federal statistics, regardless of the specific reasons.
Because trust is crucial for these numbers.
Absolutely. The BLS process is intentionally designed to prevent political meddling. Decentralized workflows, strict digital security, even physical lockdowns before releases.
So technical reasons for revisions are possible. Declining survey responses, budget cuts.
Right. The BLS budget has fallen 12% in real terms over the last decade. but Trump's intervention is seen as a shocking assault. It makes it extremely difficult for any appointee now to reestablish public trust in these vital economic indicators.
And these indicators influence interest rates, investment.
Exactly. Decision-making relies heavily on the perceived reliability of these numbers. This really shakes the foundations of economic planning and public confidence.
Okay, from data integrity, let's shift to another, perhaps more beloved, American institution facing challenges. The National Park Service.
Yeah, the article reveals the Trump administration is reportedly gutting its staff and budget, using the guise of rooting out waste, fraud, and abuse.
How bad are the cuts?
The NPS has lost nearly a quarter of its permanent employees since Trump took office. You see examples like Glacier National Park missing IT specialists and 6 firefighting roles. Smaller parks are relying on larger ones just to pay heating bills.
So it's systemic.
A systemic drain, yeah. And there's a complex bureaucratic process now for even basic purchases, like plastic bags for scientific samples.
Visitors might not notice everything directly yet. Maybe dirtier bathrooms.
Right. Maybe no worse than before, as the article puts it. But it says it's a toxic mix of confidence and ignorance in leadership, undermining the agency from within. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum, for instance, ordered parks to remain open, but his focus seems purely on access, not the long-term health and preservation.
This prompts the question, what are the long-term implications of these cuts?
Well, while Secretary Burgum wants parks open, the deep budget cuts a requested 37% reduction to its $3.3 billion budget affect core functions far beyond just hospitality or visitor services.
Like scientific research.
Crucially, yes.
Yeah.
Researchers in the Inventory and Monitoring Program, the ones who collect vital climate, weather, and species data essential for ecological health, they're being significantly cut.
So it's a broader attack on science.
The article frames it as a broader attack on science and dismissal of climate change. It risks eroding decades of progress in protecting these places, potentially causing irreversible environmental damage and impacting our understanding of these complex ecosystems.
A really concerning trend for these national treasures.
Deeply concerning.
Finally, in U.S. domestic policy, The Economist introduces us to alligator Alcatraz, which sounds, well, wild.
It does sound wild and, frankly, quite unsettling. It's a stark phrase used to describe what the article calls an exercise in performative cruelty related to immigration enforcement, particularly in Florida.
What's the specific policy?
It's exemplified by a policy providing $608 million in federal funds to states specifically for building new detention facilities.
But the article notes this contradicts public sentiment.
It does. It points out that a clear majority of Americans, 57% according to recent polls, actually oppose building new detention centers.
So what are the wider implications here, politically?
Well, it's a policy that might even alienate some Republican voters. The article cites polling showing 52% of Republicans think the government is trying to deport more people than expected.
Mm.
It really highlights this gap between broad public sentiment and certain high-profile, perhaps theatrical policy moves that seem more about political messaging, projecting a tough stance, than about reflecting public will or necessarily addressing the complex realities of immigration effectively.
Performative, as the article says.
Exactly. Performative cruelty.
All right, let's pivot now from politics to the world of money and business. Buy now, pay later, BNPL is booming. And surprisingly, the article suggests it's largely a good thing.
Yeah, that's the striking detail, isn't it? How BNPL has moved from, you know, initial suspicion and even some derision to becoming this remarkably mainstream financial tool.
The numbers are huge, right?
Absolutely staggering.
Right.
It accounted for $342 billion in spending globally last year. That's up from just $2 billion a decade ago.
Wow, that's exponential growth.
It really is.
Yeah.
And this rapid growth has attracted the big players, JP Morgan Chase, PayPal. They've all entered the market, recognizing its immense potential.
And the article then digs into something maybe even more interesting. It's not just for consumers anymore.
Right. There's this potentially even larger and currently maybe less transparent market emerging in business-to-business or B2B loans.
How are businesses using it?
Young firms in particular are using BNPL to increase their average shopping baskets by a remarkable 40%. It offers them flexibility, maybe limited alternatives compared to traditional business lending.
Okay.
Plus, there's this booming, if somewhat opaque, market for securitized BNPL debt. Asset managers like KKR, hedge funds like Elliott, they're purchasing vast portfolios of this debt. They see it as an appetizing asset class.
So despite the critics like Tucker Carlson worrying about preying on the young or hidden debt, the data looks different.
To put it in perspective, The actual default rates for BNPL loans have remained significantly lower, around 2% between 2019 and 2022, compared to traditional credit cards, which see default rates closer to 10% for similar borrowers.
That's quite a difference.
It is. Furthermore, FICO, the main provider of consumer credit scores in the U.S., is starting to include BNPL histories in their scores.
And what are they finding?
Surprisingly, for frequent borrowers, including BNPL data, can actually improve or maintain their credit scores. Now, the ultimate test will certainly come in a severe economic downturn.
Sure, that's always the stress test.
Right. But for now, the data suggests it's actually a safer and more useful financial innovation than its critics often suggest. It offers flexible credit to a wider audience, potentially improving access.
Interesting. Okay, our next topic explores these really fundamental shifts in population across the globe. We're seeing America's fertility crash, hitting new lows.
Indeed. The U.S. total fertility rate has fallen to a record low of just under 1.6 children per woman, which is well below the replacement rate of 2.1.
And the surprising thing is where the declines are steepest.
Exactly. It's not just in those traditionally low fertility urban areas like Connecticut or Massachusetts. The steepest declines are actually in historically fertile, often rural states like Alaska, North Dakota, and Utah.
Utah, but that was always held up as the model.
Right, the Utah way of high religiosity and early marriage. But this significant shift is primarily driven by young women having fewer unplanned births and delaying their first child, even there.
So what does this mean for policymakers who might point to Utah as a model?
Well, the data clearly shows that even those once fecund states are experiencing these profound changes in behavior. Fewer than 1 in 4 women in Utah now have their first child before age 25. That's a dramatic decrease just since 2005. It suggests really deeply entrenched societal shifts that go beyond just localized cultural norms.
Meanwhile, in China, the fertility rate has crashed even further.
To a stark 1.0, far, far below replacement level. And this demographic shift has had immediate tangible consequences.
Like closing schools.
Yes. The closure of 42,000 preschools. 360,000 teachers quitting as pupil numbers just plummeted. It's a huge disruption.
But there's a silver lining.
For the elderly care sector, yes, which desperately needs staff. The article notes savvy nursery teachers are actually transitioning into this growing field. It highlights how these demographic challenges can also create unexpected economic opportunities elsewhere.
This demographic discussion leads us nicely to Xi Jinping's City of the Future, Shengen.
Right, a fascinating, massive social experiment designed to manage population and development in this highly controlled way.
How's it going? Is it filling up?
It is rapidly filling, with residents reached 1.4 million by the end of last year. It's attracting branches of leading hospitals, top high schools.
And they're experimenting with the residency system, the huku.
Yes, a merit-based huku, prioritizing highly skilled workers in fields like AI and biotech. And even using short-term land leases 5 years or fewer to try and prevent hoarding and drive down prices.
But there are criticisms.
Well, yes. It's criticized as a very statist model. It displaces locals who lose their farms and factories, often with only meager compensation. And there's a risk it becomes an elite enclave that might actually struggle to attract China's most talented individuals because of the officials' extensive control over residents' lives.
A grand experiment, but with significant social costs and potential downsides.
Precisely. A huge gamble.
Okay, let's talk about the big players in business now and how they're adapting to this rapidly changing world. The article spotlights that McKinsey is losing its edge.
Yeah, the consulting industry, especially that elite trio, McKinsey, BCG, and Bain, is facing significant upheaval. While McKinsey has long seen itself as superior, maybe a bit arrogant.
It's the McKinsey mystique.
Right, BCG is now actually on track to overtake it in revenue by 2027. They seem more adept at deploying specialists and grew 5 times as fast as McKinsey in 2024.
And new competitors are emerging, like Palantir.
Exactly. Firms like Palantir, the analytics firm, offering tools to feed enterprise data into AI models, embedding engineers with clients. They're becoming formidable competitors, especially with the rise of AI. Palantir's market value, for instance, has septupled increase sevenfold over the past year to over $400 billion.
Wow.
It really indicates a profound shift in how corporate advice is being delivered and valued.
And AI itself seems to be everywhere. Its potential impact on consulting is a major theme.
Absolutely. It could certainly make consultants faster, more efficient, maybe even better. But it also raises this almost existential question.
Why pay huge sums if AI can do the grunt work?
Precisely. Why pay for combing through spreadsheets and preparing reams of PowerPoint slides if AI can handle much of that? It really challenges the traditional value proposition of high-end consulting.
Stepping back, the article mentions a toxic mix forcing businesses to adapt. What's in that mix?
Economic volatility, certainly. The strategic shift back towards fossil fuels by some companies, like BP.
BP just announced a big oil discovery in Brazil, right?
Yes, a $2.4 billion quarterly profit and their largest oil discovery in 25 years at the Boomerang Prospect. It's part of their strategy to refocus on fossil fuels. This comes while other oil giants like Chevron, ExxonMobil, Shell, Total Energies reported sharp drops in their Q2 profits. It highlights the volatility.
So fossil fuels are back in focus for some, despite climate pressures.
It seems so. And the third element is the profound impact of geopolitics on supply chains. All these factors are forcing businesses to adapt rapidly. Oh, and separately, Glencore, the mining giant, decided to keep its main listing in London, which is a bit of a boost for the British stock market.
Interesting mix of pressures. Now, how about the surprising way America's airlines are making money? It's not just flying passengers, is it?
Not primarily, no. What's fascinating here is that America's most valuable airlines, like Delta, would actually have operated at a loss last year if they relied solely on passenger revenue.
A loss? So where does the profit come from?
Their vast loyalty programs. These programs sell miles, points, whatever, to credit card issuers, American Express, Citigroup, JP Morgan Chase.
And the card companies use them as rewards.
Exactly. And this generates a massive, steady stream of profits for the airlines. It helps them manage the huge volatility of the aviation industry.
It's become so lucrative that loyalty status isn't just about flying anymore.
Right. It's often awarded based on how much customers spend with co-branded credit cards, not just how often they fly. It demonstrates the immense power of these financial ecosystems. Airlines are basically sophisticated financial services companies now, with planes attached.
That's a great way to put it. Speaking of volatility, let's talk about Donald Trump's awful trade policy, as the article puts it, creating a new imperial preference system.
Yes, the article notes his system is characterized by presidential whim. Duties aren't just higher, they're arbitrarily set, like 35-50% on Canada and India, 50% on Brazil.
That creates immense pressure on businesses.
Huge pressure. American businesses are apparently running out of ways to avoid tariff pain. They've tried stockpiling, shifting supply chains.
But new measures are clamping down.
Yes. Clamping down on circumvention schemes, making it harder to avoid duties by, say, rerouting goods through third countries like Mexico or Vietnam.
So what does this mean for specific companies operating in this environment?
Well, McDonald's, for example, is surprisingly resilient.
Why is that?
Mostly due to its franchise model. The costs are largely borne by the franchisees, not corporate. And its global revenue streams, 60% of revenues come from outside the U.S. That cushions it from U.S.-specific tariff impacts.
But for many others?
For many others, especially those with more integrated supply chains or less diversified revenue, a big squeeze on profits is coming. It's forcing major strategic reevaluations.
And the article asks about the broader global impact, right, on companies like AstraZeneca.
Exactly. AstraZeneca, despite being Britain's largest listed company, is described as falling out with Britain. They're planning to invest $50 billion in America by 2030.
Why America? Partly anticipating Trump's tariffs.
That seems to be part of it, yes. And also a belief in America's superior environment for innovation in biopharmaceuticals. It shows how profoundly U.S. policy impacts global business decisions.
Even German beer exports are affected.
Apparently dwindling due to these tariffs, leading to brewery closures in Germany. It just underscores how U.S. trade policy ripples across the globe, affecting diverse industries in sometimes unexpected ways.
Okay, now for a deep dive into the fascinating, if sometimes controversial, world of Elon Musk. The article explores the Elon Musk theory of pay.
Yeah, what stands out here is that Tesla's board granted Musk new options worth a staggering $24 billion.
But it's not just about the money for him.
Apparently not primarily. The article suggests it's really about control. Musk himself has stated he wants a 25% stake in Tesla to advance its AI and robotics capabilities. He fears being ousted by an activist investor if his stake is too small.
So the pay package is tied to his ability to steer the company's ambitious, futuristic vision and maintain authority.
That seems to be the argument, underscoring his desire for unassailable control over Tesla's direction.
But the article then peels back another layer, making a pretty provocative argument.
Right. The worse the car maker performs, the more its mercurial boss ought to be paid.
Explain that logic.
Well, Tesla is losing ground to cheaper Chinese competitors. It's suffering from reputational damage linked to Musk's politics. Yet, its sky-high valuation relies almost entirely on his futurism.
The self-driving taxis, the humanoid robots.
Exactly. His promises of those things. So the argument goes, the more the core car business struggles, the more dependent its valuation becomes on Musk's visionary, if often seemingly improbable, promises. He is the valuation, in a way.
And it's noted he's been diverting resources, like NVIDIA chips ordered by Tesla, to his other ventures, like XAI.
Yes, that's mentioned too, raising questions about resource allocation and his priorities between his various companies.
Now, connecting this to the broader picture, Uber is also preparing for the driverless age.
Yes, they're readying themselves, striking deals with companies like Wave, Lucid, and Nuro for robotaxis.
Despite previous failures in this area, they lost a lot of money before.
They did. Sank $3 billion into an in-house project before selling it off, especially after one of their test vehicles hit and killed a pedestrian. But Uber CEO, Dara Khosrowshahi, seems determined for Uber to be in the driving seat for this future of mobility.
Though he admits it's early days.
Acknowledges it's very, very early stages for commercial robotaxis.
Yes.
And Elon Musk remains a wild card here, with his ambitious, often doubted Tesla robotaxi claims. It creates this intriguing race towards autonomous transportation.
Okay, wrapping up our business section, we have a very personal take. An economist's guide to big life decisions. Framing economists like dentists.
Yeah, playfully suggesting economists like dentists can offer guidance for your well-being. Just a different kind. Humble, competent people.
And the core advice, does money buy happiness?
Basically, yes. More money generally leads to more happiness with no upper limit for most people. This contradicts some older research that suggested happiness plateaus at a certain income.
So nice things are nicer than nasty ones, as the novelist said.
Pretty much. It's a surprisingly straightforward take on the relationship between wealth and well-being from an economist's perspective.
So for you listening, what's the core takeaway regarding these big life choices, according to The Economist?
Well, the article emphasizes that the biggest impact on life outcomes is actually your place of birth. The returns to migration for those in non-rich countries are sky high.
Like moving from a poor country to America.
The example given is a typical 30-year-old man with secondary education moving from a poor country to America could see a benefit of about $14,000 a year, even after adjusting for price differences. That's huge.
And big decisions like university.
Usually a good bet, economically speaking. But the returns vary wildly depending on what you study. Male medics and economists might see a £500,000 lifetime wage bump in the UK example given, while creative arts might offer little to no financial benefit on average.
It really underscores the economic rationale behind certain life paths.
It does. Now, for older individuals, the advice shifts. It acknowledges it's harder to significantly improve earning power later in life.
So the focus changes.
Yes. To maximizing happiness and actively avoiding loneliness, which is identified as a major risk factor for well-being in later life.
But the economist can't fix everything, unlike the dentist, perhaps.
Right. The economist, unlike the dentist, can't fill in career gaps or polish a grubby CV. There are no drills for remedial work. It highlights the limitations of purely economic advice without considering individual agency, context, and, well, life itself. Economics provides frameworks, but it's not the whole story.
Yeah. A good dose of humility there. Okay, let's explore the frontiers of human knowledge now, starting with a truly cosmic mystery. Astronomers apparently can't agree on how fast the universe is expanding.
Yeah, a core revelation in the article is what's known as the Hubble tension. It's this stubborn and actually growing discrepancy.
Between two different measurement methods.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Two primary methods of measuring the universe's expansion rate give different answers. One, based on direct measurements of distant galaxies using things like Cepheid variable stars and supernovae, gives a value around 73 kilometers per second per megaparsec.
Okay.
The other method looks at the cosmic microwave background radiation, the afterglow of the Big Bang, and predicts a rate closer to 67 kilometers FEMPC based on our standard model of the universe.
And this discrepancy won't go away.
It refuses to go away, despite repeated checks and refinements of the measurements. It makes it impossible to know the universe's exact age or size with certainty.
And what takes this even further is the implication. It might not just be a measurement error.
Right. Some astronomers believe it hints at deeper problems with the standard model of cosmology itself. That's Lambda CDM, our prevailing theory.
The one based on dark energy and dark matter dominating?
That's the one. The tension suggests that one of the fundamental assumptions within that model might be profoundly wrong, which is, frankly, groundbreaking if true.
It could mean a new paradigm shift in our understanding of the entire universe is on the horizon.
Potentially, yes. A really exciting, if puzzling, time in cosmology.
But this discussion about scientific certainty, or lack thereof, prompts a critical question about the integrity of science more broadly.
Yes, the article highlights a very concerning trend. Fraudulent scientific papers are booming.
Booming? How fast?
Their number is estimated to be doubling every 1.5 years since 2010. Meanwhile, the total number of scientific articles published only doubles every 15 years.
So fraudulent research is growing exponentially faster than legitimate research.
That's the implication. It threatens the very foundation of the scientific enterprise and our trust in published knowledge.
So what does this all signify for scientific credibility, especially for you as a consumer of information relying on studies?
Well, the analysis suggests these paper mills are using AI to generate fake research. They then sell authorship to academics who are desperate to boost their publication numbers for career advancement.
And even journal editors might be involved.
Alarmingly, yes. Some editors may be complicit, creating networks to deliberately bypass proper peer review. This widespread fraud is undermining scientific credibility across the board.
Particularly in medicine.
Especially concerning in medicine, yes. Flawed or fake research can directly impact clinical guidelines derived from systematic reviews. If the underlying papers are garbage, the conclusions drawn could be wrong, potentially harming patients.
It's a profound crisis of truth within the very systems designed to find it.
A deep crisis, absolutely.
Okay, let's shift to a more practical application of science and technology, the detection of hypersonic missiles.
Right. Hypersonic missiles are tricky because they're designed to evade traditional radar. They fly inside Earth's atmosphere and can maneuver unpredictably.
So, how can they be detected? The article mentions an innovative approach.
Yes, from a company called HyperKelp. It involves using buoys equipped with microphones deployed in the deep ocean.
Microphones. To listen for them.
To detect their sonic booms as they travel. It's actually an ingenious reapplication of an old idea. Think of the 1930s sound mirrors used by the RAF to detect incoming aircraft, or even Ukraine's current Sky Fortress drone detection system, which also uses acoustic sensors.
Bringing an old technique into the modern age, what's particularly striking about this for you?
Well, these buoys are relatively low cost, which makes the system scalable. They're also hard to take out. Destroying one buoy doesn't disable the whole network.
And they can pinpoint the location.
They can triangulate positions to provide accurate locations, functioning essentially as a tripwire far from American shores. Now, the article notes it's likely a temporary solution in the constant arms race.
Sure, countermeasures will likely be developed.
Exactly. But it's a clever countermove right now. It reintroduces acoustics as a viable detection method, challenging conventional wisdom in military defense thinking.
Very interesting. Finally, a dive into personal health advice. Should you take collagen?
Ah, yes. Collagen supplements. They're very much in vogue, aren't they? For purported benefits to skin, joints, hair, nails.
But the article suggests the benefits are
unclear and decidedly mixed. While some reviews do indicate maybe a decrease in skin wrinkling or some positive effects on joints, the underlying mechanism is really debated. Does the collagen survive digestion intact? Or is it just broken down into amino acids like any other protein?
So what does this mean for you and your health choices? Is it worth the money?
Well, the research suggests that the benefits often attributed specifically to collagen might actually just come from consuming protein in general. Collagen supplements are essentially just protein powder, albeit rich in specific amino acids like glycine and proline.
Meaning cheaper proteins might work just as well.
Potentially better, even. Cheaper, more complete proteins like whey could be a more effective option for general health and muscle synthesis. And for a useful hack, the article points out that gelatin, which is just processed collagen, can be bought at a fraction of the cost of fancy supplements.
So gelatin could be a budget-friendly alternative if you want to try it out.
Exactly. Worth considering before spending a lot on specialized collagen powders.
Got it. Okay, now for a look at culture and society, starting with the novels conservatives want you to read, an interesting angle on literature shaping worldviews.
Yes. It focuses on Christopher Scalia's book, 13 Novels Conservatives Will Love, but probably haven't read. He suggests these novels impart what he sees as conservative virtues, faith, resilience, living within society.
What kind of books does he highlight?
He praises works by Willa Cather, like My Antonia, seeing it as dignifying diligence and stoicism, about the complexity of the American dream, individual agency, hard work, sacrifice. He also reads Zora Neale Hurston's Their eyes were watching God through a lens of the main character Janie's enterprising toughness.
And V.S. Naipaul.
Yes, a bend in the river. Praise for rejecting simplistic views and countering groupthink that diminishes Western culture. It's a fascinating attempt to curate a specific literary canon for a particular ideology.
Which prompts the question the article touches on. How much do novels really shape a polity beyond just entertainment?
Right. Bertolt Brecht famously said, "Art is not a mirror held up to reality, but a hammer with which to shape it."
Implying literature can actively influence and mold societal values and political discourse.
Exactly. Which makes the choice of what to read, or indeed what not to read, a significant cultural battleground.
And that connects directly to the next piece, America's Barmy Battle to Ban Body Books in School Libraries.
Yes, it describes organized groups characterized by one librarian as Christian nationalists who are working from a script, pushing for bans on books they deem inappropriate.
Harassing librarians. Using AI.
Oh. Harassing librarians, yes. And even using AI tools like ChatGPT to screen books for naughty bits. Though the article notes the AI is unreliable and easily fooled by context, it can't really understand nuance.
And this partisan battle over books is now explicitly tied to national politics.
It seems so. President Biden had appointed a book ban coordinator to address censorship concerns. But one of the first acts of Donald Trump's education department was reportedly to eliminate this position, calling the whole issue Biden's book ban hoax.
Wow, it clearly shows how these cultural issues, like what's available in school libraries, become weaponized in broader political discourse.
And how quickly one administration can reverse the policies of another on such a sensitive topic. A fascinating, if concerning, example of culture becoming a political football.
Let's talk about something perhaps a little more fun, maybe spooky. Why Wednesday is wittedly successful.
Ah, the Netflix show. It thrives on that clever mix of the ordinary and the eerie, right? Heavily influenced by Tim Burton's gothic aesthetic and his longtime musical collaborator, Danny Elfman.
But its success isn't just the style.
Not just the snappy script and jump scares, no. Fundamentally, it comes from the Addams family's enduring appeal. Beneath all the macabre and zany exterior, they're presented as this functional, loving, deeply accepting family.
Kinder than the normies.
As the article puts it, they're often kinder, better people than the normies who hate them. This makes the show both heartening and spooky, tapping into that timeless appeal of the outsider who is actually okay, maybe even better off.
That leads us nicely to the surprising depth found in swimming pools as cauldrons of envy, danger, and lust. Seems there's a lot more to a swimming pool in fiction than just water.
Absolutely. What's fascinating here is how swimming pools serve as these really potent symbols in literature and film.
Representing a rival, social status.
Yes. Think mobsters reclining by the pool in heist movies. It signifies they've made it. But pools can also represent profound disappointment. Like in John Cheever's famous short story, The Swimmer, where the protagonist's journey through his neighbor's pools reveals his own diminished status and collapsing life.
And there's spaces where propriety clashes with exposed flesh.
Definitely. Leading to flirtation, ogling, social awkwardness, as seen in shows like The White Lotus. Yet, they can also be these portals to childhood joy, bringing different generations together.
But there's often a darker side. Contamination. Danger.
Right. Contamination in pools, whether it's just sunscreen film or something more sinister like a bomb in the film The Swimmers, is often used as a harbinger of trouble, reflecting deeper anxieties or hidden dangers. Think of the opening scene of Sunset Boulevard.
A rich symbol indeed. Finally, shifting to lifestyle, the article states, Provence is not just a destination, it is a lifestyle brand.
Yeah, it highlights how the idea of Provence has become this pervasive marketing tool. It gets attached to everything from olive oil to beauty products, promising to transport you directly to the idyllic French countryside.
And its brand is tied to rosé wine.
Deeply tied to its rosé wine, yes. Exports have nearly tripled over the past decade, largely fueled by demand in America and Britain. Rosé is Provence in marketing terms.
But there's a paradox. Social media boosting the image but causing problems.
Exactly. Social media fills Instagram feeds with beautiful pictures, boosting its desirable image. But this also leads to severe overcrowding. The example given is Gourdes, a picturesque village with only 1,664 residents.
Attracting how many tourists?
1 million tourists annually. It creates this real tension between the idyllic image and the harsh reality of mass tourism, effectively loving a place to death.
A common problem for beautiful destinations. Okay, turning our attention now to Britain, we have a fascinating and quite unsettling obituary. for Patrick Ryan, the devil's disciple.
Yes, this details the surprising and frankly disturbing life of a former Catholic priest who became known as one of Britain's most wanted men.
For improving IRA bomb making.
Specifically by supplying some 900 small, round Swiss timers. These were crucial for more sophisticated IRA bombs. He played a direct role in deadly attacks like the 1984 Brighton bomb targeting Margaret Thatcher.
Which she narrowly survived.
Yes. And the attack on the Household Cavalry in Hyde Park in 1982, which killed 4 men and 7 horses.
And his lack of regret is noted.
Chillingly so. He stated his only regret was that I wasn't even more effective. This, contrasted with someone like Jerry Adams's more whimsical, avuncular tweets about cupcakes today, raises poignant questions about how historical figures involved in violence are remembered and the complex, often unresolved nature of political reconciliation.
Speaking of influential figures who challenged expectations, The Economist profiles Stella Remington, who battled communists, terrorists, and literary critics.
Right. She was the first female head of MI5, Britain's domestic intelligence agency. And notably, the inspiration for Judi Dench's M in the James Bond films.
But the article contrasts the fictional glamour with her reality.
Very much so. Her actual spying life was apparently pretty dull at times, including reading novels under her desk while colleagues drank whiskey. Not very Bond-like.
And she wrote her own spy novels.
She did. And interestingly, they focused more on domesticity, challenging traditional thriller tropes. Her heroine was often more concerned with her washing machine than exotic escapades.
Influencing portrayals of female spies.
The article argues, yes, influencing shows like Black Doves on Netflix, which features a female spy who is also a mother. So she was a trailblazer, not just in intelligence, but perhaps also in shaping literary and screen portrayals.
Now, Britain itself is grappling with its identity, post-Brexit economic stagnation, leading the article to ask, what's Britain good at?
And surprisingly, despite the prevailing narrative of gloom, the article argues Britain is actually still an innovation nation, doing remarkably well in several key areas.
Such as?
It boasts 4 of the world's top 10 universities, as a dense innovation cluster in Cambridge, described as densest on Earth, Europe's largest venture capital market.
Strong in specific sectors, too.
Yes. Strong in advanced manufacturing. Life sciences, think AstraZeneca, or DeepMind's AlphaFold breakthrough, which happened in London in technology. With deep expertise in machine learning from firms like DeepMind and the autonomous vehicle software company Wayve.
But here's the kicker. Britain struggles to keep these companies.
That's the major problem highlighted. It struggles to scale and retain these high-growth firms. Too often, it serves as a launch pad before companies leave for better conditions elsewhere, like the U.S. or Australia.
Like that Scottish space firm considering launching from Australia.
Skyrora, yes. Considering launching rockets from Australia due to lack of available slots in the UK, the article points to crippling industrial energy costs and a confusing spaghetti of schemes for entrepreneurs as key problems. It's a clear economic challenge. Great at starting things, not so great at growing them.
Politically, Labour's Sir Keir Starmer faces a challenge with his vision for a stricter labor market.
Yes. The article details the Starmer versus the Brio taxi problem. It highlights this inherent tension between his party's worker rights agenda, wanting to give gig workers more rights, potentially employee status, and the flexible gig economy model represented by companies like Deliveroo.
If he tightens the rules,
consumers might face costlier, less reliable takeaways. A smaller, less flexible delivery network could result, similar to what happened when Lausanne and Switzerland deemed Uber drivers employees, leading to higher prices and longer waits. It's a classic economic trade-off between worker security and consumer convenience cost.
This creates an opening for the Green Party.
Potentially. The article notes they're currently in a leadership election, deciding whether to become more combative and try to eat into Labour's base with a kind of eco-populist approach, or remain their traditional nice selves, focusing more on local campaigns.
Their choice could impact the general election.
It could. A small number of voters switching from Labour to a more aggressive Green Party could actually dash Labour's chances in key marginal constituencies. It highlights the delicate electoral balance.
Finally, looking at Europe more broadly, the European University Institute in Florence is debating its relevance.
Right. In a continent grappling with rising Eurosceptic nationalism, how does an institution dedicated to European integration stay relevant? Its new director, Patricia Nance, has an interesting idea.
Which is?
Suggesting that joint sovereignty in crucial areas like digital tech and AI could be a common ground. Even nationalists might agree that only by acting together can European countries hope to compete effectively with America and China in these critical fields. It's a pragmatic vision for future European cooperation, focusing on necessity.
And in Albania, there's progress on corruption.
Significant progress, it seems. The new anti-corruption unit, known as SPING, is really taking down bigwigs. Former President Salih Berisha and Ilir Meta, even the powerful mayor of Tirana, Arjen Veljash, who was seen as a potential successor to the prime minister.
And it has public support.
Impressive public support, 76% public trust. Even the prime minister, Edi Rama, who initially attacked SPAC, had to back down due to EU pressure and strong public opinion. It demonstrates the growing power and legitimacy of this independent body in a country often plagued by corruption. A positive sign.
Lastly, a quick note on African air travel. Still difficult.
Remarkably difficult, yes. Hindered by a lack of competition, fusty national carriers often dominate, charging high prices, struggling with credit, plus high taxes, averaging twice those in the Middle East.
And visas.
Byzantine visa rules, as the article puts it. Less than a third of intra-African trips are visa-free. All this severely hinders movement and business within the continent.
Forcing business travelers to meet outside Africa.
Exactly. Meeting in places like Doha instead of African capitals. It highlights a fundamental impediment to continental integration and economic growth across Africa. Still a long way to go.
And that brings us to the end of another, well, pretty insightful deep dive into The Economist this week. We've covered so much, from the tragic human toll of global conflicts to subtle shifts in demographic trends, and even the very future of scientific integrity.
We really have. We've seen how political whims can impact everything from the credibility of national statistics all the way to global trade patterns, and how technological advancements like AI and autonomous vehicles are, you know, fundamentally reshaping entire industries and even our personal finances.
You know, what truly stands out to me from this deep dive is just how interconnected everything really is. It always does, but this week particularly.
Right.
A change in U.S. trade policy can impact a brewery in Germany and simultaneously affect oil prices in India. A local political battle over redistricting in Texas can genuinely influence national power dynamics in D.C.
Yeah.
And even the way we consume pop culture, like a Netflix show about a spooky teenager or a painting of a swimming pool, can actually reveal deeper truths about our society and anxieties.
And what's truly fascinating here, I think, is that even as we strive for greater knowledge and certainty, whether it's about the universe's expansion rate or the future of work, there's always this underlying tension, a tension between established paradigms and emerging realities.
Mm.
The source has highlighted how even economists are grappling with this, suggesting that maybe fear of loss, fear of missing out, might actually be a more powerful driver of markets and human decisions than our traditional models based on rational risk assessment.
Challenging fundamental assumptions about human behavior.
Exactly.
So for you listening, what does this all mean for navigating the world around you? Perhaps the real challenge isn't just to absorb more information, though that's important.
But maybe to constantly question the frameworks through which we understand it.
Yes. To recognize that in this world of complex, often contradictory forces, the most valuable insights might come from stepping back. Identifying those unexpected connections, the surprising details, and maybe the underlying human impulses like fear driving it all.
So consider this. How do you filter out the noise and find the signal in this incredibly rich, sometimes messy reality we've discussed? What paradigm shifts are you seeing in your own world, big or small?
And what does that fear of missing out, or just fear in general, truly mean for your decisions, both the big life choices and the everyday ones?
Lots to think about.
We hope this deep dive helps you navigate those questions. Thank you so much for joining us.
Until next time, keep digging deeper.